And our very special guest tonight, David Sirita. You know, he wanted to become an astronaut a long time ago. And now he's one of the best when it comes to UFOs. We'll be with David in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. David Sirita's first aspiration in life, as I mentioned, was to become an astronaut. In 1968, he and a friend witnessed a UFO along with hundreds of other witnesses. After this experience, David grew up as a UFO enthusiast, never living in doubt of the phenomena that has swept the world since the Roswell incident in 1947. His interest in space, religion, philosophy, astronomy, and science led him on his career in related fields, and he has studied world religion, science, physics, paranormal psychology for more than 25 years. He's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hello, David. How are you?
Good, actually. Good to meet you, George, in person at the Bay Area UFO Expo on September 9th and 10th.
Yeah, that was fun. I had a good time out there. How about you?
Good. Yeah, it was great. You know, I like sitting down and meeting all the people and having them come up to my table and tell me their UFO stories.
Do you go to many conferences, David?
I've lectured everywhere from Dallas to Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco. Not a lot anymore. I prefer to do this, to speak on the radio, but it's always nice to meet people face to face. And, you know, the turnouts are, you know, that was a decent turnout at that conference. I mean, sometimes I spoke in Roswell once and you only get, maybe a couple hundred people out there and you think that thousands would flock out to the desert.
Are you still trying to get on a space shuttle?
Well, that's one of the things I did at the conference. I announced something kind of radical, and I'm not even expecting this to work, but I'm announcing a petition to petition my way to Congress on the space shuttle to look for UFOs, because so many Americans believe that NASA is not forthcoming in telling us the truth about what they're seeing on these missions, and what we'll talk about in a minute is STS-115. And my take on that. And in fact, I actually, when I was doing my film Evidence the Case for NASA UFOs, throughout doing my research throughout the 1990s, one of my dialogues was with a NASA scientist named Dr. Joseph Newth III, who was head of the astrochemistry branch at the Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. And one of the things he told me was that if you get enough signatures from the American public, you might be able to petition your way onto the shuttle to end this debate. Are there really UFOs, or is everything just dust and debris and space junk? So I decided to, take him up on that.
Well, what's going to happen?
Well, I don't think I'm actually – I mean, I'm a skydiver. I really don't have my fear of going into space, but I think realistically – one day I would like to have a sponsor. I mean, that would be my biggest dream, would be have somebody sponsor me and put me on a Russian rocket onto the space station, but that would cost an awful lot of money. I want to make a point with this. I mean, with my signatures, when I bring them to NASA, I'm actually going to videotape my arriving there, showing them how many people really believe you guys are not telling us the truth, and I'll demonstrate why. For example, when I was talking to Joseph Newth III during our debates about whether we were seeing debris or space junk, firstly, I researched what space junk really is, and it's mostly defined as pieces of small, like at the most 10 centimeters in size, pieces of tin foil. They never throw solar panels and doors and, big trash bins out into space.
Right.
In fact, I found when I researched the shuttle, they rarely ever dump water. They recycle it, and only in a case of emergency they would dump it, because water is very heavy and very expensive to bring out into space. So in the current story, in fact, one of the debates I got in with Joseph Newth III was that he said this, if there are five cameras mounted in the bay and you can take any two of them that are seeing the same object and you can triangulate the distance between the two cameras and match them up into, using trigonometry, you can determine the distance between the camera and the object. And when STS-115 was being reported around the, the 19th and 20th of this month, one of the things the NASA spokesman said is that we don't know how far away the objects are, and therefore we don't know how big they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that was just pure bull. I mean, NASA was just pulling the wool over people's eyes, and any good mathematician knows that that's not true. In fact, if you can triangulate the distance between two using two cameras, you do know how big the objects are, and they, you consider that the space shuttle orbits the Earth 300 miles above the Earth. The top of the atmosphere is 100 miles. And most junk, which is tin foil and very tiny pieces of debris, would fall and decay into much lower orbits. You would never see anything that far away from the shuttle. If the shuttle's at 300 miles and your space junk is even 50 miles away, you're not going to see it.
No, you, even a handful of tin foil, you wouldn't
and,
see
and
it.
And then you have to wonder, the other thing is, why, when space junk is routine, it's something astronauts are trained to see, why this mission did they suddenly make a big deal out of space junk? Like, all of a sudden, in fact, one of the reports was, and Fox News National was reporting this very distinctly differently than CNN and NBC and ABC. On Fox National, one of the astronauts said, quote, that this is very serious. There is an object outside, and it's passing us. And he was very alarmed and very serious. I don't believe an astronaut would be that alarmed over a piece of space junk. In fact, for the object to be passing them, the shuttle is going prograde orbits around the Earth with the motion of gravity at 18,000 miles an hour, making 90-minute orbits. So if you're passing the shuttle, you have to have internal energy or you're a meteorite. And meteorites are doing 35, 45,000 miles an hour, and they go streaking by, and you can barely – in fact, you don't even see them because they – you don't see them until they strike the top of the atmosphere. They're a kind of void in the area where the shuttle is. The shuttle is 200 miles above the top of the atmosphere. So you really got to wonder what these guys were seeing. And then going into – my source, Donald Ratch, he actually goes to the NASA library and he sends me, has been sending me videotapes from starting from STS-114, which was the first mission after the big accident 2 summers ago. And during that mission, an amazing object showed up that I've been studying and zooming in on. It's actually in my Dan Aykroyd movie. It looks to me like a golden mean rectangle, and it has the perfect dimensions, 1 to 1.618. dimensions of a golden mean rectangle, and I immediately thought of the, you know, Arthur C. Clarke's movie, you know, 2001 and 2010, and the golden rectangles that were appearing, you know, the mysterious objects that signify a higher intelligence in the universe. And this thing is luminous. It's a golden mean rectangle. It has a pulse. It's very bright, and from a distance, it would be cylindrical. Well,
right.
During STS-115, the reports were that the object was cylindrical. Those were some of the early reports coming in. I was listening as I was traveling from the north, and I was getting calls from friends who were watching the news. And another one was more pill-shaped or disc-shaped. And then you think, okay, then STS-121, Jeff Challenger posted on the Internet this disc-shaped, very translucent, low mass, which are the kind of UFOs I look for. Luminous object just suddenly seems to be going by. And one of the things, first things that NASA says is these are pieces of debris that are floating up off the floor in the shuttle, and when they get close to the camera, they produce this optical illusion. Well, one of the things I did with, for example, on STS-75, the famous tether incident, is I took, you know, my 3CCD video camera, which CCD video cameras have phenomenal depth of field of focus. I mean, phenomenal. You can have a penny right in front of the camera, and when the camera's unzoomed, and 300 miles in the distance, the Earth below is in focus. So your depth of field of focus is phenomenal. So that means you could see something getting close to the lens, but when you zoom in, even on a dime disappears completely from the focal plane of the camera. Now, in the STS-75, you see these things floating around out there. They're all pulsing. They're all going at different velocities, which debris could never do.
Debris goes at the same rate.
It all drifts at the same rate, and that gets into Newton and Galileo, you know, Newtonian physics, unless it has internal energy. And so that was the first thing I noticed. And then it survives this long zoom into the shot, and nothing disappears. In fact, the zoom just keeps going on and on and on, and you hear the astronaut say that he's completely zoomed in, and they're still there, which means they're very far away. They're very distant objects, and that's when we see them going behind the tether. So, again, looking, you know, at STS-115, this most recent story, you know, I think looking at NASA's official definition of space junk, they don't throw the trash out the trash chute. They have a wealth of photography of real space junk, and it's possible. Why were all the astronauts so alarmed, and why did they make a big deal out of space junk if it's something they see on every mission? And then all of a sudden we hear that it's junk, and they come up with some of these photographs, but none of the photographs are identified with actual parts, like in a service manual. This is a trash bag. This, and the one that someone said was a trash bag, when I looked at it, you know, it's really a beautiful-looking shape, whatever it is.
Is 15STS-115, is that the most remarkable of all of these possibilities?
No, actually it isn't. But what's the most remarkable about it is that the word UFO was used all over the media. And it's the I was actually so excited. I was coming out of my skin, you know, telling my fiance Crystal, oh, my God, they're actually admitting on the news that they're making contact with an unidentified flying object. And, in fact, in NASA's SIM Planet Quest, they have this, you know, search for extraterrestrial planets. At the last slide on their PowerPoint presentation, NASA says they hope to find proof of life in other worlds. And in fact, they anticipated that when they formed NASA in 1958, you know, during the studies that they did on how, you know, the Brookings Report studies and how humans would respond if they did find evidence of extraterrestrial life. And it's really this beautiful image, and you really think, oh, NASA's going to tell us if they made contact. And this is another one of those cases. Now, I can't say I know that they're not looking at space junk. I can just point to all the reasons why I think they're not telling us the truth. They could easily give us some fake footage from another mission, and we don't know what we're seeing of pieces of junk. But I'm just telling you from simple physics, and then you get into something even more complicated. From simple physics, I don't believe, firstly, the astronauts would be alarmed over space junk. There's no way junk can travel faster than the space shuttle and pass it.
And it was moving along, and you're right, and passing.
And it couldn't even keep up to it. It would actually drift behind it. Very slowly, it would drift away, and then it would be so far away. And then when you look at the manual definition of what junk is, they never throw anything away out there that is bigger than a piece of tinfoil that's a couple of centimeters across.
Well,
and that's
now,
some of the biggest.
What do you think, David, really? What do you think it was, and how big do you think it might have been?
Well, from being an experienced photographer for 25 years and looking at what happens when objects get further and further away from you, their lack of detail gets greater and greater and greater, depending on the optics and the film or the videotape you're looking at. But from experience, I would say there's no doubt those objects are very far away because there's not a lot of detail. It's very poor detail. There's only one still photo that might have been taken with a very long lens of something that's supposed to be some kind of a trash bag, but it doesn't look anything like a trash bag to me. In fact, it's a very sophisticated-looking shape. And I don't know what, no one has ever identified it in a manual with a part.
Now, how did we, the world, find out about this? And if it indeed was a cover where they had to say, oh my gosh, it's space debris, that means the video was spotted by us before they wanted us to see it. How did that all happen?
Well, see, that's all been happening. People watch NASA television, and there's a lot of guys like Donald Ratch and Martin Stubbs in Canada and Jeff Challenger and literally hundreds of others who...
And Hoagland, all these people,
all of
right?
them are archiving NASA TV live, and then, you know, you start to see these luminous pulsing objects, which I've watched on, you know, YouTube of 115, and people start asking questions, what is that? But never before in the history of spaceflight has NASA been so alarmed over space junk. And, you know, when Richard Hoagland came on, I was driving, you know, the first night. I mean, he was suspicious right away.
Yes.
And was, I thought, was being quite conservative. And I don't know if he saw the Fox National report versus CNN. It was very different. The astronauts were clearly alarmed. And I just can't accept that you guys aren't trained to know what space junk is, because every other mission preceding this one, the astronauts know what it is. And they never make a big deal. Oh, my God, we're being followed by a trash bag, and the whole world needs to know about it. Why did we all need to hear the word UFO and then find out it was space junk? And
how did that happen? Tell me about that, the word UFO.
And is that a cover for NASA to say that all of the preceding footage of anomalous objects are just space junk and the case is resolved? There was even some talk on Fox National that in the end they still don't know what the objects were, and there were some reports that the astronauts had seen things like this and they've never known what they are. And that means you have unidentified. How did it happen?
Yeah, who coined the phrase on this mission that it was a UFO that they saw?
Well, it's the word just UFO just started to appear in headlines all over the place. And I
so think, you think media people developed it?
No, I think it was an astronaut who used that term. I think that was the first report I heard on Fox National. But the astronaut and the quote, I mean, Katie Coleman, astronaut Catherine Coleman, you know, this is in the beginning of my Aykroyd movie. She's quoted as saying we have an unidentified flying object. And then when congressional investigations were done into this, she said, oh, she was just kidding. But you never hear any laughter. All you hear is dead silence after she says that. And then I know from studying the space shuttle that there are two channels on the space shuttle. One is an encrypted Department of Defense radio broadcast, and the other is the public channel. When she makes a statement like that and there's no laughter, I can't believe she's just kidding around. In fact, you know, why was there so much silence after she said that? And I think that's because they switched to the other channel. So that was – she's actually used the word UFO before. But
of course, though, UFO also could mean, you know, an object that is unidentified. Doesn't have to
sure.
be a flying craft.
Sure, but they know what space junk is. And as I'm defining it by their manual, 10 centimeters in length pieces of tinfoil, you will not see those from 50 miles away or 100 miles away, let alone – the top of the atmosphere at 200 miles away from the shuttle. I mean, you can't see anything from that far away unless it's massive. So the further this alleged space junk gets away, and the fact that you can actually see it, it means it's bigger than the manual definition of space junk. They don't throw away solar panels and doors and you know, big pieces of junk. I mean, we have the booster stages of rockets that... but those things drop very quickly back down into the Earth and disintegrate in the atmosphere. So you're not looking at anything like that. So why is it that you're seeing something that is obviously larger than any definition of space junk? I think the astronauts were seeing UFOs, and I think they have been seeing them, and that's why the petition. It's going to be up on my website in a couple of days, the davidserrita.blogspot that you have.
You want to go up there with your equipment, with some cameras?
I want to go up there.
You want to find one.
Invisible wavelength cameras, and that's another thing. Dr. Joseph Knuth III told me very clearly, and I've gotten into this debate with James Oberg, very clearly, and in fact I have the notes right in front of me here, on the exact wavelengths that the low-level black and white cameras can see into. And he says that basically... the camera, first he says it can see visible and near ultraviolet photons. We do not see ultraviolet with the naked eye. It's invisible to the naked eye. Ultraviolet is divided into near ultraviolet, far ultraviolet, and extreme ultraviolet. All three of them are wider in bandwidth than the rainbow spectrum that we see from red to violet. But when he actually gives me the different types of sensors on the actual camera itself, he says, quote, I would be amazed if the optics were not cored so that the UV ultraviolet cutoff wavelength would be 180 nanometers, if sapphire cutoff drops to 160 nanometers, and if for CAF2 the cutoff is 135 nanometers. Well, inadvertently, he's actually telling me that if the camera is not only seeing near ultraviolet, it's actually seeing into the far UV, because far UV sees, you know, 200 to 10 nanometers, and we're going below 200 nanometers when we're talking about 135 nanometers. So we're actually seeing into the far UV as well as the near UV, and that's incredible depth into the invisible spectra that human beings don't see. And that's another area of UFO phenomena that I've talked about before.
Hey, David, so, when we come back after the break, though, let's also talk about our friend Eric Julien, the former French air traffic controller. He claimed we were going to get zapped a few months ago. Nothing ever happened. I want to get your reaction to that, okay?
All right.
We'll talk about that and some other things with David Serrita. David's website, we've got a couple direct links at coasttocoastam.com. That includes his website and his blog. So go take a look at those. His new book, Evidence, the Case for NASA UFOs. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. You remember several weeks ago when we had that Twilight Zone contest, eight of you won. We played various clips from Twilight Zone episodes, and you guessed the correct title of the program. The books are all accumulated now, and they should be going out within the next week or two, those of you, the eight of you, who have been waiting. And originally I was going to give out one book, then two. It ends up you're going to get three apiece. So take advantage of it and have some fun. And we'll do that every once in a while. It's a good way to just kind of clean out the stockpile of guests' books because I'm not going to throw them away. I'd rather you have them. I'd also like you to have the After Dark newsletter. You get 14 issues now for the price of 12. Great stories in there. Call 1-888-727-5505 or go online at coasttocoastam.com. Lots to talk about with David Cerita. David, let's talk about Eric Julian. He was so convinced that we were going to get zapped by an asteroid or something was going to hit us, and nothing ever did. Give me your take on all that, because, you know, for a moment, it seems like you understood him, then you kind of even backed away from it.
Well, I think I heard his story, but you have to refresh my memory on it.
He was the one who, he's the former French air traffic controller, and he's the one who thought that several months ago there was a definitive asteroid that was going to hit us. He even had the date picked. He even had the location.
Remember?
Yeah, he thought it was going to splash into the ocean, and nothing ever happened. But, I mean, this guy believed it so much, he really stuck his neck out.
Yeah, there were stories going all over the Internet about it. You know, most of the predictions in the psychic world, I mean, some are accurate, some are not. I mean, I've dealt with, you know, psychic phenomena, and some I've met some very, very good psychics. But I kind of take it with a grain of salt, because it's not that they don't get accurate information. It's just that, and in this case, I don't even believe it was 100% psychic. I think they were, you know, NASA was actually searching for these things out there. But the game of prediction in quantum physics is brutal. I mean, scientists are happy when they can get close to 1% accuracy in prediction. And then when you get into astrophysical models, you know, planets in the galaxies and shooting stars and meteorites, it's still very difficult, even for some of the best physicists, to predict when they see these things coming in if they're going to actually strike us. So, and then there are our spiritual forces at play. I really believe in the if you get millions of people thinking, you know, to avoid a collision, you can actually do that. So it's hard to tell, you know, what is actually happening in the end, you know, and how that all played out.
If you could change one thing in any ufologist's quest to get information, if you could obtain a piece of data that was just so compelling, what would you want to see, whether it be a government file or information that some witness, David, gave you? What would you like to see?
Well, more than anything, what drives me on this is you know, seeing this UFO in Berkeley in 1968. It's actually Albany, walking home from school, and, you know, clearly looking at a metallic shimmering disc that was silent, defying gravity. I would want to know, was that UFO one of ours, or was it from another planet? But the answer is already coming to me, and even right now I'm filming my new film, From Here to Andromeda, which starts with, you know, me as a pessimist not believing that we're actually going to save, you know, our planet, and we need to find a new planet to live on. And one of the things I did is we went to my elementary school, which I haven't been to in over 35 years.
That's a trip. And doesn't it look small when you go back there?
It's incredible. I mean, I remembered everything, how I walked home from school, you know, the honeysuckles along the fence. But this is going to scare you. What I saw was on the pavement in the asphalt in the basketball court, I saw this kid who made a drawing of himself. And this kid's a good drawer. He draws his checkered shirt, his face and his eyes.
Yeah.
And right across from him on the asphalt is an extraterrestrial. And I filmed this. And, you know, when people see this, they're going to think, in my new film, I made this up. But I swear on anything, I will give any oath that this is absolutely true. And what are the odds that I would come back to my school, and I haven't even seen it in over 38 years? I'm 45 today. That was in 1967.
Oh, by the way, happy birthday, David.
Thank you. and that another kid is obviously having experiences. And I started to think, well, what if, you know, Berkeley is a portal, and what if they have been contacting children there for, you know, decades, and I was just one of many contactees in that school. And what started to happen to me were dreams about the propulsion systems of the UFO. And then when I started to play hide-and-go-seek and kick the can in San Francisco, I would count to 100 looking at the Pleiades. And then when I saw the Billy Meyer photographs, I said, you know, on television in the 1970s, I went, oh, my God, that was the epiphany for that, that, oh, my God, UFOs are a phenomenon. I saw one of those when I was a kid, and I never stopped thinking about it.
That was the clincher for you, wasn't it?
So I would want to know the answer. I mean, and one of the things I did during the filming is I went up to the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, and why are UFOs always being seen and crashing near our nuclear labs, our research labs? Lawrence Berkeley National Lab has a perfect view, and I got some video footage right where I saw the UFO. And then you think of Roswell and, you know, Los Alamos and the Trinity site. I mean, it seems like UFOs, and even the caller you had tonight who talked about the UFOs in Vietnam, you wonder if they're watching us in our wars and in our dramas, and they're really following our progress scientifically in aeronautics and space. So that would be the answer I would want to know. I would want my question answered first. But I'm starting to think that it wasn't one of ours. The dreams would not happen if it was one of ours about the propulsion system. There was some definite telepathy going on. And I do have one traumatic memory in that when we moved from Albany on the Berkeley border to a house in Berkeley, when my mother remarried David Cooper, my name became David Cooper, I remember having this babysitter. And in the middle of the night, I went into sleep paralysis. And it was so terrifying that I woke up screaming my head off like a maniac, and I still remember it, like feverish, almost feverish temperature of fear in my body. But there's something behind the fear and why I was screaming and what was happening to me in the paralysis that I don't remember. And I think there might have been a contact going on, and it was just too terrifying for me at that age to deal with.
What a thing for a little lad to go through, Dave.
Yeah, I mean, and to throw me off in life. You know, I did always want to be an astronaut from that point on, but I think I could have had, I could have gone down the straight and narrow and been a lawyer or a doctor and not have been bothered by all this. But now my love for propulsion and how to move through the universe has actually led to tonight the release of my new book, Singularity. Actually, the book that I'm releasing now is Singularity, which we've talked about two times on your show, and
yes,
I've made major breakthroughs in, and that's at lulu.com/David Sirita.
I want to devote next hour to David to talk about propulsion systems, mm-hmm, and what you think might be used for them to travel and what we might have to do in the future as well. But do you believe that there is a dual space program going on at NASA, one that we see and one that, and I don't mean for the military now, but one that is so black ops, mm-hmm, that we may never see?
Oh, I believe that without question. In fact, some of the stories I heard at the conference were from people who had been near. I've had three people who don't even know each other who all have told me about giant triangles in east of Riverside, California, near Death Valley. And it can't be a coincidence. And all of them have pointed to Lockheed Martin. In these giant triangles. In fact, at the conference, I asked John Lear and about UFOs just at dinner. I just introduced myself, and he was, you know, his daughter was a huge fan of the new Aykroyd movie I have out. And he said, all the UFOs, the ones that, the triangles, the Phoenix lights, they're all ours. But the real ETs are here, but they're keeping a low profile. And I thought, damn, I wish I got that on camera because I think I might believe him. I think I believe that there is an alternative space program. And now, this is even more shocking. CNN announced on September 1st, 2006, that if we destroy this planet, this is the headline, will science find us a new one? And when I looked at those headlines, I had already started filming From Here to Andromeda, which is all about that. If we destroy this planet, will science find us a new one? And then you think of what the question you just posed. If we already have an alternative space program, are, you know, authorities on this planet or secret societies choosing who gets to exodus planet Earth and go to the new planet?
If need be.
And why is it that NASA says, I mean, they have this very aggressive, it's called SIM, S-I-M, Planet Quest, Searching for New Worlds. NASA is now going ultra-aggressive. Dr. Geoff Marcy at the UC Berkeley is one of the heads of the project, and they've searched more than, they've identified more than 160 planets in solar systems since 1995, but not one of them, they claim, can sustain human life.
If I were an elitist, David, if I were an elitist, the first thing I would do, assuming then I had more money than God, mm-hmm. I would want to make sure that I had some kind of massive underground bunker that would give me the lifestyle that I was accustomed to, if I was making that kind of money and if I were an elitist. So I would take care of that problem first. Mm-hmm. And let's assume they've done that. I think that's the easy one. Then the second one would be these Illuminati folks. Mm-hmm. They would say, now, you know, first of all, we tap into taxpayers' money all the time. We use it whenever we want. What are we going to do if an asteroid hits this planet and wipes out the entire planet and our bunker doesn't even work? What's our next step to survive?
I know, and it's kind of, to me, I kind of like that as a suspense, you know, mechanism that God or the Creator puts into and the fear of that threat into the human perspective, because we have to figure out the greatest problem in physics, which I tackle in Singularity, which is how do you get from here to another star system, let alone if our galaxy is very young and doesn't have organic life as we are, and how do you get to find another planet? And then you think of, for example, the Buddhist perspective. In fact, this is a question I would love to oppose to the Dalai Lama when he was here. You think about, in Tibetan Buddhism, when we die, every one of us approaches the clear light of enlightenment, which is really heaven from the Christian perspective. But most fear it because they're afraid of that much love, that much joy, that much ecstasy. We actually fear it because we're not evolved enough to live in it. So we reject it. We judge it retrospect to the truth that it is in relationship to where we're really at. And we go, oh, my God, I can't handle that much love. So we go back to school, this school called Earth, but it's not there anymore because we destroyed it. Now, where do 8 billion souls go, and only a percentage of them, according to the Buddhists, can enter heaven because they're not evolved enough? In Buddhism, if you fear the clear light heaven, you have to reincarnate in the organic, you know, human flesh realm to keep learning until you can evolve to the point where you can withstand that intensity of enlightenment to live with it permanently. Now, in the Buddhist perspective, if there's no bodies for you to reincarnate into, and if many of us have been reincarnating as souls on this planet for millennia, and say I have thousands of lifetimes on this planet, where do I go next? I mean, as a soul, well, we think, okay, that's what my movie's about, From Here to Andromeda. I want to find out how to get to Andromeda because NASA can't even find a single planet in our galaxy. So let's try the closest galaxy, but it's 2.2 million light years away, and doing the speed of light, it's going to take you 2.2 million years to get there.
Can't do it.
And if you find a planet, and you find out they have their souls that reincarnate on their planet, and they're doing a good job, they're not going to destroy their planet, would they want us? Would they want us who won't even screw in an energy-saving light bulb? I mean, most of us, I mean, that's what's at stake here. In fact, recently I wrote Edgar Mitchell about this because I wanted to interview him for the film, and he said, well, forget that. Why don't we just fight and save our own planet? Well, I've been a fighter my whole life, you know, planting over a million trees and working on nuclear fusion and blah, 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 all of it. But at this point, even with Schwarzenegger's 25% reduction in greenhouse gases for California, Richard Branson's glorious man, he's one of my greatest heroes. And I look up to Richard Branson, you know, more than almost anybody on the planet in the
Yeah, he's a fighter, isn't he?
I love him. I always looked at him and thought, man, he's a high school dropout, just like Einstein was a college dropout. I always admire people who just say, look, you know, I want to get outside the box. I know I'm going to do something different, and they make it. And you know, Einstein ultimately gets a PhD, which I think was mostly honorary because he never really went through school. He didn't even do well in college. He was failing in his classes. And then his one mind, that one person's mind affects the entire planet. Well, that's that's where we're at now. And even with the, you know, we got less than 1% of the planet using renewable energy and sustainable technologies, I don't think we're going to make it. With the increase in people driving cars, the increase in population, the lack of massive emergency status effort to save the planet, I think it's come to this. And that's why I think CNN announced this. And why is NASA being so aggressive to find a new planet? That's, you know, on CNN. It's September 1st, 2006, for people who want to look it up. It was actually in Popular Science, I think it was. CNN referred to it from that article.
Well, they better have the wormhole, David, because that's the only way they're going to get
there.
Well,
the wormholes don't even work, and that's one of the reasons I ultimately come to singularity, the ultimate theory of how you can move anywhere in the universe in zero time. You know, Richard Branson's building the spaceport in New Mexico. There's a lot of exciting things happening. Al Gore's film, the many episodes on 2020 about, you know, Al Gore, the perspective of how life will end on Earth. But ultimately, I think God wants us to evolve. So if it's an asteroid that beckons us with our end, we have to figure this out. We have to find out how to go interstellar. And with current physics and current propulsion methods, including wormholes, you can't do it. Because wormholes take too much energy, more energy than God to make a wormhole. You need the negative energy of 100 million suns, the total solar output for a whole year, to make a wormhole big enough to transport a quarter through. And the wider the diameter of the snout of the wormhole, the more energy it takes. So you can't do wormholes, at least not the way we're approaching them. So this is like the ultimate conundrum. I mean, it doesn't look like enough people care on this planet to save this place. And maybe when you know, I'm hoping with this new film, this journey from here to Andromeda, when we finally get it, that we're still a million years away from figuring out how to go intergalactic, let alone interstellar. We have to save this place, and it has to be an emergency.
Do you really think, David, we're going to be around for another million years, humankind?
I think, here's what I think, and this is pretty radical. I think, and I can demonstrate why I think this, just like when the dinosaurs went extinct, there are extraterrestrials who know we're about to go extinct, and they're fighting over this planet right now. I don't believe the flying saucers are just getting, you know, accidentally crashing all over the place. There's these UFO crashes all over the place. When you look at Ryan Wood's book, you know, his crash retrieval conference in Vegas coming up, Magic Eyes Only is his book, you see the numbers of saucer crashes. And then when you get into the physics of the crash and you go from, you know, what's his name, from Washington, I don't know why my brain's going blank on him. But anyway, all the way to Roswell, all the way to today, you look at the UFO crashes. Ken Arnold's sighting.
Yes.
For example, Ken Arnold's sighting, here's a classic case. He determines the UFOs are going between Rainier and Mount Adams at 1,800 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the speed of a bullet is about 1,500 miles an hour in World War II. You're talking 1947 here. And then you think, okay, could you shoot down a UFO with one of our munitions at that time? No, you can't. I mean, even going that speed, which is nowhere near their top speed, if the munition is slower than the motion of the craft, you know, you're playing, you know, craps in Vegas. I mean, with your bullets, you're never going to hit the thing. And then you look at the numbers of them that are crashing, and you think, how could you go from one star system to another, and you finally get here? It's like me driving between, which I just did, between Vancouver, Canada, and L.A., 1,500 miles, and I crash when I open the front door. It's kind of that ridiculous.
Let's talk about singularity when we come back, David, on Coast to Coast AM.